This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Zach Moore, and you know, when I was gone, Ken Tripp, he covered for me for quite a few weeks, so I think it's only fair we give him a week off, and I'm taking the show on today, guys, but don't worry, I'm not alone, and we'll get to our guests in a second, but you know, we've had kind of a mini-series of podcasts during Ken and I's time here on Standard Orbit called Star Trek Origins, where we explore certain, dare I say, nexuses, both real and fictional, that became defining touchstones for the franchise for years to come. And you can find these previous discussions in Standard Orbit 139, 145, and 161. But today, we're bringing it back in a big way and examining how the often maligned third season is responsible for a lot of what we now deem iconic Star Trek. Honorable Klingons, Klingon-Romulan coexistence, Lady Killer Kirk. The list goes on. And we're honored to be joined by author and webmaster of the movie blog, Mr. Darren Mooney. What's up, Darren?
Hey, how are things, Zach? Pleased to be
good.
Here.
Good. And so it's first of all, before we get started, it's great to be podcasting with you again, man. Darren and I became associates through the X-Cast, Tony Black, who hosts Primitive Culture here on Trek FM. So we're all just becoming one world podcast, right, Darren? That's our goal.
We are sort of conglomerating. There will be only one podcast group, but no, it is. We're actually, and I think it's funny because to spoil the illusion of podcasting, we recorded several months ago, but they're actually being released, I think, at the moment. So if you sort of like this combo of myself and yourself, you can sort of tune into, I think, the X-Cast this week, and we'll be talking about Grotesque, possibly. Possibly not talking grotesquely about Grotesque, but...
Is that this week?
I believe
lose track.
That might
it's
be
funny,
this
yeah.
Week.
So yeah. Pulling back the curtain, as they say, we did. Yeah. We did these podcasts.
It is the illusion. Your podcast is not broadcast live into your ear, unfortunately, every time you play it. I feel like, yeah, I've peered behind the curtain. I've ruined Christmas. I feel like I've ruined Christmas now. The illusion is just gone.
You know, before we dive into today's topic, which you yourself suggested, so thank you for that. It kind of fit into, like I said, our little mini series about Star Trek Origins here. Let's talk a little bit about your Star Trek fandom, how it developed over the years, and where it is now.
Well, I mean, in terms of my Star Trek fandom, I grew up in what I'm Irish. As you can tell from my distinctive Irish brogue, I sound exactly like
I thought
like
you were Scottish. I'm sorry, I'm mistaken.
Sort of Celtic-y. Some sort of vague British Isles residence sort of thing going on. But yeah, my accent is not necessarily distinct to the Irish. But I grew up over there, and when I was young, I moved over to Ghana in West Africa. My dad had to get a job there. And what I would do is I would have people in Ireland send me tapes and copies of television from Ireland over to Ghana. And my gran and my granddad were big Star Trek fans. In particular, my gran was a fan of The Next Generation, stuff like that. So she would send me over tape recordings of these episodes that she got off the TV, which you'd watch on, say, Sky One over here. This would have been when The Next Generation was on the air and stuff like that. So I would get random episodes every once in a while. And I remember in particular getting Gambit from the... You know the seventh season of The Next Generation? You know, Gambit Part 1. I remember getting Gambit Part 1 and having to wait, like, 5 years until I saw it on syndicated reruns and actually seeing how that episode resolved. If I recall correctly,
and to cut you off, but if I recall correctly, the cliffhanger is what, like Riker and Picard like fire on the Enterprise? Is that the cliffhanger? Yeah. Or okay,
that's it exactly. It's Picard and Riker become space pirates because Gene Roddenberry's not around anymore and can't enforce that no space pirates rule. So why not? Let's go with it. It's the final season. We'll just embrace it. But I grew up with sort of Star Trek in that sense, and then later on when I moved to Saigon and my dad moved back, we had a little sort of Star Trek fan club of sort of small country town. It's a very small country town. But while we were there, I sort of fell in with a group of people. And what we do is we get people in the States would occasionally send us videos, and we'd meet once a week and we'd watch them during the season. So we would have watched like Broken Link. I remember watching Broken Link with a bunch of Star Trek fans in a small Irish town, probably like a couple of months after it aired in the US, but several months before it aired in the UK and stuff. And so it sort of evolved from there. And I mean, I retroactively discovered the original series. Which is the thing, which is kind of great, because I got it in, the VHS wave that came around, like, 99, 2000, where they'd have three episodes on each tape. And so,
I've seen that in the UK, where you have three, four episodes on a tape. We never had that here. We had one episode per tape. One episode per tape.
That is ridiculous. And I assume they cost, like, what, $13, $15, or euro? Well, for us, it was pound sterling. But
yeah, it was $15 or $20 for one... for one videotape. I remember me and my family, we had a handful of like season one TNG episodes, because those weren't really in syndication very often. So it was like, oh look, these weird episodes with Riker doesn't have a beard, you know. It's like some weird
and they're
special
wearing suits
thing
that are giving them back problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I had a similar sort of thing going on. Like, you're lucky we had three episodes. I remember, like, the advent of DVD just changed everything in terms of watching television. Because then you could buy, like, originally it was like $80 or £80 for a set. But now, you know, over a couple of years, it was like you could get 26 episodes of something on television for €20 or $20, which would be unimaginable to me as a child. Mm-hmm. Like I can't get over how cheap I could get Miami Vice or whatever. So that's how I you should watch, everybody series. Should watch Miami Vice. Everybody
and
should watch.
Magnum PI, all the good stuff, right?
Yeah, all the great stuff. So that's sort of how I got into it. That was sort of the basis of my fandom.
So you were not a TOS dyed in the wool proper fan, are you?
Harsh. I'm getting a cold reception on this podcast. And I like that the reception's going to get even colder when I'm like, you know, season three is horribly underrated. In my defense, I feel the need to say, in my defense, when we were airing, when I was watching television over here in Ireland in syndication during the day, we didn't air a lot of TOS. We didn't air a lot of the original series. We tended to cycle through The Next Generation. We tend to cycle through Voyager. We didn't cycle through Deep Space Nine, actually, which I found interesting. I think that's because serialization sort of made it more difficult to have on at like 5 o'clock in an evening. Because I would remember when I was a kid going to school, I'd come home from school, I'd do my homework, sit down to dinner, and like The Next Generation would be on, and I'd just sort of watch it that way. I actually had to seek out the original series. And I think actually this is probably a little embarrassing for somebody who's on a podcast about the original series. I think my first encounter with the cast of the original series was watching the movies. Because the movies were available to rent in the local Blockbuster store, or Extravision is what we had here. So I got to know Kirk through the films almost before I got to go back and go, hey, who's that guy? He's not wearing a wig. That's not Kirk at all.
That's up for debate. Second of all, nothing to be ashamed of for the movies. I mean, to me, like my Star Treks are, because I'm a child of the Next Generation. You know, I was born in '87. I'm the same age as the Next Generation, so that's my Star Trek. And then the original series movies are my Star Trek. I mean, that's really what I grew up watching. You know, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, even 6. Star Trek 6 is my first theatrical memory. Going to the movies when I was a kid. I don't remember the movie. I remember my dad I think either like I fell asleep or something, and that's why he was like holding me, or we were standing there. But I remember like standing at near the end, like bottom of the theater, watching the main credits, like with their signatures and stuff. You know, that's like my first theatrical memory. But all that to say,
that's amazing. That's a really great theatrical memory. I remember at one stage, and I don't remember the circumstance of this, so I should probably not tell this because this is going to make it sound like I had a horrific childhood. But I remember one weekend where it was either my brother's birthday or my own birthday, my mom making a point to sneak off early to go see First Contact without us.
Oh, wow.
Because she had enough going on that she wasn't going to be able to make it with us, so she went to see it by herself.
And I thought my parents were Trekkies. Goodness gracious.
It's really, really great. And I have those memories of watching. I remember watching First Contact. Actually, First Contact is the only Star Trek movie, or the first Star Trek movie I remember seeing in cinemas, and I think that was sort of a good one to have.
Did you see Nemesis in the theater?
I did, but that was not a good memory. I don't treasure that one.
I was going to say, if you didn't, then it's all your fault that we didn't get a Star Trek 11 until 2009. But anyway, that's beside the point. Star Trek at its best, really, is the movies, I think, in my opinion. You know, those original series movies, that's the gold standard for all things Star Trek. And so nothing to be ashamed there, my friend. And a lot of people retroactively discover the original series, much like yourself, you know, because they see, because that's like, you know, the original series, of course, they had a budget, they were just trying things out, you know. But the original series movies, even though they had a lower budget than, you know, like the J.J. Abrams movies, for example, still, you know, it was very polished. Like Star Trek the Motion Picture is still probably the most epic of all the Star Trek movies, you know, and like highbrow sci-fi ideas and in special effects, you know, and just polished storytelling scope. So, you know, we love all things Captain Kirk and the Enterprise here on Standard Orbit. So you're in good company. But one final question for you about TOS. So now that you've rediscovered it, do you prefer production order or broadcast order, or do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I would be a person who would prefer probably production order, in large part because I feel like watching the series, and I mean reading, I recently did a sort of a rewatch of Star Trek and the various Star Trek shows, and I've done reviews on the blog or whatever to give a shameless plug there. But like one of the joys of watching it was watching it and reading along with stuff like, say, Mark Cushman's These Are the Voyages or other companion texts, behind the scenes stuff like Ralph Sarensky's website, which is a fantastic resource, and going through sort of episode by episode and sort of like charting. You're right when you said that they innovated and they pushed the envelope and they were doing things that nobody else was doing. And if you watch it in production order, you get to see them doing that, which is just incredible to me. Like, I know, you know, narratively or in terms of broadcast, you have that original context, but watching it in terms of production order is like you can see week on week the production team being like, okay, well, we did this last week. Maybe this week we can try doing this. And you sort of see them grow and stumble and fall. And like the first season of the original series, and I know I'm on here to talk about the third, but the first season of the original series just has this wonderful progressive arc where they start out sort of stumbling out the gate because nobody had done anything like this before. And nobody involved really had any idea, I think, of what they were doing at the start of it. And then you get towards the end where you have these Gene L. Coon scripts, which are just like back-to-back, wall-to-wall, fantastic. You have like Devil in the Dark, Errand of Mercy, City on the Edge of Forever, like A Taste of Armageddon. You've just got Space Siege. You've just got this hammer from about 20 episodes in through to, I think it runs 29, doesn't it, the first season, if you count the cage?
Yeah, 29 or 30, because there's like the Menagerie Part 1 and 2, and sometimes you count it as twice. But yeah, you got 30 episodes, give or take, in season 1.
And it just, it's a season that, like, barring Operation Annihilate, you know, it just builds to this wonderful crescendo, like where the City on the Edge of Forever is like, okay, we figured out what the hell we're doing. This is amazing.
And you if only they had just, you know, just dropped off Operation Annihilate, right? And let City on the Edge of Forever be the cap of the season. It would have been something special, right?
Yeah, you kind of imagine that after they wrap, like, City on the Edge of Forever, there's a point where everyone goes, okay, we're done, it's great. And then somebody else goes, you do know that there's one more episode due this year. And just going, crap.
Watch out for this flying fake vomit, guys.
I like Operation Annihilate, but it is no City on the Edge of Forever or Errand of Mercy or Space Seed or any number of those other great episodes.
Not quite a classic, no, sir.
No.
No, I got you there. And, you know, to that point, you know, the first season of the original series is amazing. Some of the best seasons of television. And then season two as well. So, you know, to get into our discussion today, let's get to it. Season three gets a bad rep. You know, and yes, it's not as strong as the first two seasons of the show. That's an incredibly high bar to live up to. I mean, if you just go down the list, the ratio of good to bad episodes is incredibly in the favor of good for the first 2 years. So with season three, with budget cuts and cancellation looming, it's hard to blame them for losing steam at the end there. You know, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, his presence had dialed back. They had new producer Fred Freiberger. You know, there was frustration around. Just knowing that their time slot had been moved, so there was a lot of stuff, you know, behind the scenes going on influencing it. But even so, the third season is responsible for a lot of what is deemed iconic Star Trek, both in pop culture and in deeper Star Trek lore.
Yeah, I would argue that, and I think that one of the things about the third season is that you got to keep in mind a lot of people who watch Star Trek, because I mean, we talk about ourselves discovering it retroactively. It's not just us doing that. It's a lot of the writers who worked on the show have also talked about how they would have discovered it in syndicated reruns during sort of daytime television. Like there's I think Ronald D. Moore has talked about that's how he used to watch it. Manny Coto, for example, has talked about how his memory of watching the original series is that he would watch it and he would actually time the episodes in syndication over and over again. So you go, okay, I just watched the Doomsday Machine. I know that I'm going to have to wait another, you know, 16 weeks before I see that episode again. That sort of stuff, where you would have the episodes airing sort of back to back in five blocks. So there's really, when you're watching it in syndication, there was no real distinction in terms of like break in terms of time or continuity between sort of the first, the second and the third season. They're all just sort of, they run together over 16 weeks over and over again. And what's interesting to me about the third season is when I went back and watched it, like, it is a woefully uneven season of television with some of the worst episodes of Star Trek ever produced. So it obviously, like, The Way to Eden. We don't need to legislate this. You have The Way to Eden, like, Spock's Brain, Turnabout Intruder, which is one of the worst finales in the history of television. And you just have this sort of, like, this thoughtful stuff, which people are understandably kind of very sensitive about, and they don't see it, like, living up to the legacy of, like, the first two seasons where we had, like, as we talked about the first season, you have this wonderful crescendo with The City on the Edge of Forever. But even the second season, you have stuff like Journey to Babel. You've got, like, all this sort of other stuff, Trouble with Tribbles. You've got these wonderful episodes that sort of speak to what Star Trek is and what's sort of, like, been sort of baked down the idealized version of Star Trek in terms of, like, fandom and in terms of what we want and what we expect from these characters. But when I went back and I watched the third season from beginning to end, well, I was surprised by a number of things. And the thing that most surprised me is the fact that a lot of the third season of Star Trek has sort of become ingrained and sort of, like, encompassed in the fan memory of the thing. Because, like, one of the things I'm very interested in sci-fi and very interested in sci-fi fandoms. One of the things about sci-fi fandoms is that the memory of the thing is not always the thing itself. In terms of how we remember, say, continuity or whatever, mm-hmm. is not always exactly what happened. Like, and it's particularly with, say, the original series with Spock, where, like, fans have this very idealized version of Spock as a character who never lies. And, you know, they have this idea of Vulcans. Like, when Enterprise appeared and everyone's all like, Vulcans are not horrible people. What is this show doing? Vulcans are nice people. And you go back and you actually, like, you watch Journey to Babel, and Sarek is hella racist. And also just a jerk
very
to his son. Yeah, and horrible to his son. Or even like a Mock Time where, like, you know, they're all like, oh, by the way, it's okay. Spock will fight to the death with the person he loves and then he won't want a mate. So I can go and I can go do my own thing. And you're like, yeah, Vulcans, maybe.
And they don't even tell Kirk gets to the death until after he agrees to do it. It's like, that would have been nice to know.
Yeah, you have this sort of sense that, like, Vulcans, because fans love Spock, because Spock is lovable in general, Vulcans are, you know, they weren't as idealized as our memory sort of perceives them to be. And I think there's a lot of that with the third season, where fan consensus has sort of said, look, third season is terrible and awful and woeful, and a lot of it is. But you go back and you watch it, and there's a lot of it that carries over. Like, there's a lot of stuff that is, I think of, like, as quintessentially Star Trek. That sort of you see develop over the course of the third season. And I mean, there are a number of these things, but the most obvious thing that jumps out to me, and you sort of, you mentioned it in your introduction there, is the first thing is the idea of Kirk as a lady killer, right? As Kirk as sort of this womanizing, like, I don't want to say Zap Brannigan-esque figure, but the idea that Kirk is like a guy with a girl in every spaceport, where he's got this sort of charm offensive in the form of William Shatner. Now, there are episodes in the first couple of seasons where Kirk would sort of turn that on. Dagger of the Mind comes to mind with the infamous The Only Christmas Party. And you imagine that the reason why it's the only Christmas party in Star Trek history is because that's the one where Kirk hooks up with a yeoman or whatever. But you have
she was a doctor, I believe, give her due credit.
Apologies. But you
Dr.
do have
Helen Noel. Because it's a Christmas party, you get it?
Yeah, Dagger of the Mind came towards the start of the season. Remember how I talked about the first season ramping up? But you do have this sort of sense of, like, Kirk in the first two seasons was kind of this intellectual, remote sort of figure. He wasn't exactly like Picard, but he's also not like the Kirk in popular memory, or the Kirk from the movies, where he's like an action hero. Like, there was a lot of introspection in Kirk in those first two years.
A couple points there, you know, in the early scripts, you could easily switch him out for Jeffrey Hunter's Captain Pike, you know? Yeah. Or, you know, like, the man trap, he's, like, upset that people are dying, and he's, like, Mud's women, these women come on, he's not having any of it, you know? Yeah. He's just, I mean, he has a little bit of charm, but at the most point, he's, like, he's sticking to business, you know?
Yeah, or even Balance of Terror, like, where you have this sort of melancholy figure, like, you have this sort of, like, very solemn individual.
But, you know, in the first couple of years, there would be a lot of past loves for Kirk that would come on, you know, for the Deadly Years or Shore Leave or Court Martial, you know?
Yeah, Kirk's ex-girlfriends or whatever.
But no one, like, he wouldn't, like, meet some random person and go, oh, hello, you know, that would happen every now and then. But sometimes he would, a lot of times he would use it
yeah.
to his advantage, like Conscience of the King or Cat's Paw, you know?
Yeah, or even, like, do androids, sorry, what are little girls made of? That sort of stuff. Yeah. Kirk sort of weaponizes.
Do androids dream of electric sheep? No, yeah, that's a different robot question mark title, but yes. Yeah.
But, yeah, you have that sort of, that same sort of idea of, like, Kirk. And even then, it's like Kirk is being, even in applying his sexuality, Kirk is being sort of professional and cold and rational. Have you read the, have you actually read Gene Roddenberry's novelization of the motion picture? Kirk very coldly and very rationally, when the Elia probe beams back, Kirk very coldly and very rationally in Gene Roddenberry prose basically realizes that the only way to get the Enterprise out of this situation is to teach the robot to feel emotions. And to do that, you need to seduce her. And Kirk sort of, like, it's very cold and it's very rational. You can see, like, Kirk works through, like, the angles. He's like, okay, well, look, it's going to have to be me or it's going to have to be Decker, right? Decker has the advantage of, like, being the man that Elia loves. So he's got a little bit of an inroad there. But on the other hand, I'm James Tiberius Kirk. I know what I'm doing in this case. So we have to weigh up these options very carefully. And there's a good...
That is hilarious. That is so Gene Roddenberry.
It is. But I think when you get to the third season, though, when you had, like, Friedberger come in, and you had this sort of... one of the things that Friedberger did when he assumed sort of command of the ship of state was he tried to make the show broader. He tried to find a way to expand beyond what he perceived to be, like, genre fans, which were, like, young men. He tried to attract, and it was a horribly misguided decision, both in terms of what he did and how he tried to do it. But he basically said, like, what if we can attract female viewers? And how do we attract female viewers to Star Trek? Which is ignoring the fact that, A, like, the cornerstones of Star Trek fandom are mostly women, actually. Like, people like Beau Trimble, for example, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Susan Sackett, who are grossly overlooked when we talk about Star Trek fandom. And B, it's very gross and sort of generalization in terms of, well, women like romance, right? We'll just stick in some lovey-dovey stuff.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a huge criticism of the third season. Like, who is falling in love this week?
Yeah.
Romance of the week, not just for Kirk, but for anybody, for Spock, for Scotty, even McCoy gets some action this season, right?
Yeah, and I think that, like, Kirk sort of, like, the idea of Kirk as a lady killer, I think, is sort of sown to that, because you have in very rapid succession, you have, for example, like, the Paradise Syndrome, which is the one where Kirk becomes Kurok, goes, like, full Native American,
marries
and has a family, yeah, shouting at the wind. And then you also have stuff like, for example, you have, like, later on in the season, you have Ilan of Troyes, where he falls in love with Ilan after he touches her tears. You have, like, even Whom Gods Destroy, which, like, when people think of Kirk as a lady killer, they think of him making out with, like, green alien space babes.
It's the only time that happens.
This is the only time that happens. You have then later on in the season, even in episodes that are not specifically about Kirk falling in love, like, for example, the Cloudminders, where you have, like, a wrestling match with a knife on a bed. Like,
that was very bizarre, and he's, like, enjoying it, too.
Yeah. He's kind of into it a little bit.
But the Cloudminders, though, that is, to me, that is the worst example of... the, what do you want to call them, like, I'm trying to think of the terminology, but, like, the okay, well, Spock, they just make him, like, a normal guy.
Yeah, that's like, exactly. He's Spock, like, oh, well, Spock gets a love interest in that episode.
I've never met a work of art before. And Kirk's like, what? Is this? What are you doing, man? This is my territory. I'm supposed to do this. It's just, very interesting. And he's talking to some girl he just met about Ponfar, which he wouldn't even tell Kirk about a year ago. And that is the biggest betrayal of Spock's character. You know, I'm not saying that he has to always, you know, inconsistency of character is character, as they say. Right? So that's fine and all, but it just really sticks out, like, this is the same Spock we just saw wouldn't even tell Kirk that, you know, he had to go home to get married a year ago. But anyway.
But, like, again, this is the season where Kirk, like, you know, thinks he's a Native American and marries a woman, and then she dies and he goes off and never talks about it again. Even stuff like Requiem for Methuselah, where Kirk falls in love with an android, but falls in love with her so profoundly that Spock has to wipe his memory at the end of it in order to...
You might appreciate this. I'm an editor by trade, so I did a little fan edit at the end of City Edge of Forever a few years ago. Okay. And what I did was I edited the end of Requiem for Methuselah. I edited the scene a little bit, you know, cut out specific references to the end of City on the Edge of Forever, right? Yeah. And you know, I think it works really well. I think it's a better ending for that episode because I remember in Ellison's original script, you know, there's a scene where Spock visits Kirk in his quarters, you know, and tells him, you know, no one gave up the universe for love and all that stuff. He doesn't erase his memory or anything. but you think to yourself, like, okay, if there was one situation where that was called for, that would be it, you know. So I think it worked pretty well. And then of course YouTube took it down and no one's ever seen it, and I would like to share it with people, but I can't. But anyway, but, I thought it worked pretty well. But I'll have to say, you know, to your point, season three sowing the seeds for things, right?
Yeah.
And we can talk about Kirk as a Lothario forever here, but we can touch on that in a second. But that reminds me though, at the end of Requiem for Methuselah, Spock minds all with Kirk and tells him, forget, you know. And I don't know if this was on the radar when they were looking for remember in Star Trek II, but there's a clear like remember forget, like you can see like where they might have taken this space seed, if you will, and used it in Star Trek II.
Yeah, like there is even a lot of that little stuff. Like I think even when you remember, when you think of, and this is going to be awful because this is one of the things where you have the difference between the popular memory of Star Trek and the fan memory of Star Trek, where you have like. When people think of Star Trek, they think of like Star Trek as broad social allegory and commentary and stuff like that. And 9 times out of 10, I guarantee you, people are thinking of the episode Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, which any Star Trek fan who's watched it knows is a terrible piece of television. But
that's one of my favorite episodes from season 3.
Okay.
because it just, to me, yes, it's absurd, but that's the whole point. The racism is absurd. He's like, well, you're black on one side and white on the other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, he's black, you're white. What's the difference? You know, I think making it, to me, although it's almost naive in its simplicity, it informs where we should be as a society in the 23rd century, where it's so incomprehensible that people would like feel this way about a different skin color, you know? And I think, you know, I get it's a little cheesy. They do, for some reason, because Frank Gorshin is a guest star, they do all like the Batman pop zooms with the red alerts. I'd like, where did that come from? And then, you know, there's a little too much running at the end.
Yes, and no budget as well. You can tell like this is one of the episodes where they spent all the budget on Gorshin, so they're like, okay, run
guys,
around
keep,
a bit.
Keep running. We got 5 more minutes to fill. But I do really like that episode. So, but yes, that is the quintessential Star Trek ham-fisted look.
Like issue storytelling. Sort of
it's modern day issues in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, even then, like you have like Star Trek did a number of like space hippie episodes. Like for example, I would argue This Side of Paradise in the first season is a space hippie episode. But like when people say space hippies, they always think of The Way to Eden. Like I think that there's an argument to be made that like even just in terms of visual or in terms of like storytelling, when people think of those aspects of Star Trek, like they think of those episodes in the third season because they are cartoonish. Like the third season is, I think, much more cartoonish than the first two were. Like and you can see that even when Shatner's performance, like for example in the one with And the Children Shall Lead, has one of those great.
That's the worst episode of Star Trek.
It is, but it has one of those, like, when people think of William Shatner overacting, like, Shatner is relatively, I would argue, contained in the first two seasons, barring episodes like, say, The Enemy Within or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, there are points when he starts cramming scenery down his throat, but they're relatively sort of contained in those first two seasons. In the third season, and again, I don't know whether reading accounts behind the scenes, whether this is just because he was bored or because he was trying to compete with sort of Nimoy for screen time. But he just goes full-fledged.
Full Shatner.
Repeatedly. Yeah, he goes full Shatner.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the scene in the turbo lift. Where I'm this is the scene. Because me and Brandon Shamatella did a commentary on this a couple months ago. We have fun doing commentaries on some of the lesser episodes of Star Trek. Yeah. And that scene, I was like, this is what people think of when they talk about Shatner's neck. That's exactly what you're talking about. Like, I don't know why. Because it's still one of the worst episodes. Why does everyone remember that? I don't know why. But it's just the way he moves, the way he talks, like everything, like that is the Captain Kirk parody. Yeah. When someone does a Captain Kirk parody, that is what they're doing, that scene in the turbo lift.
And I mean, even outside of that, you have episodes like The Turnabout Intruder, which is a terrible piece of television. And actually, I love Shatner's performance in it, because Shatner's performance in it is like the one thing that is enjoyable to watch.
It's entertaining, isn't it? Like you can see what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know?
He's doing this full sort of parody of masculinity. Like it's you know, this horrible woman who hates men who's pretending to be a man. And it's got this sort of it's got layers, like an onion that's gone off a great deal, but it's still got layers. And you sort of like, I think that the third season has that quality in terms of like Shatner's performance. Like when people who are Star Trek fans or are not Star Trek fans, when they think of William Shatner acting and they're like, oh no, what is going on? That's what they're thinking of. They're thinking of those scenes in those episodes. And it's kind of interesting to wonder why they seem to... I think maybe the reason why they latched on more than, say, the first or second season, when Shatner is... Like, Shatner is a fantastic actor when he's on. Like, he's really, really great. He's like City on the Edge of Forever. It's just a powerful emotional rollercoaster, and a large part of that's down to Shatner. But the reason why I think people remember Shatner as third season Shatner is because, like, a lot of the third season is sort of cartoonish. It's, like, exaggerated. So, you know, like when you remember something, you remember the broad strokes, the big details, the neon signs. Like when you remember Shatner's acting, you don't remember like the quiet detail of him standing there with Edith Keeler talking about how the most important three words in the English language are "let me help." You think, oh no, what is wrong? Him freaking out in the turbo lift, or you think of him on the command chair with his eyes wide open, sort of his back completely straight, staring out at the audience as if he's having some sort of acid trip. Because
well, even in the better episodes, like Enterprise Incident, which is one of my favorite episodes of the whole series, it's part of the plot though. Like he's acting like he's lost his mind. He's like, "I'll kill you! Oh, you traitor!" You know, he's just like, "What? What?" But that's intentional. That's part of the story. And then also like in Whom Gods Destroy, right, where he's like throwing a fit. That's not Kirk. That's Garth.
It's Shatner as Garth as Kirk, and you can tell he's
like,
just...
no.
And I mean, actually, it's funny, like you mentioned those episodes, like Garth of Izar is this character who appeared in the back, like he shouldn't be a major character in the Star Trek canon in any shape or form, but he is. Like people are obsessed with Garth. Like remember when Star Trek Discovery came on, everyone's all like, oh, by the way, is Jason Isaacs playing Garth? Or you have like Axanar and stuff like that. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about it, but
well,
you have that.
I recall like back when they were looking for I guess I don't know for I call them guest stars, but yeah, you know, for in the movies, in the JJ movies, they're like, oh, could Garth be the villain in Into Darkness? Like what, Garth of Izar? Come on, guys! Like
he appeared in one episode. It wasn't a good episode, but for some reason,
I like that one too. Let's you know, before we get any deeper down the rabbit hole here, what episodes of season 3 do you actually like, Darren? I'm just very curious.
Okay,
because
most of the ones
that I've like that you've mentioned, it's one of the worst pieces of television in history. Like I'm like, I like that one.
I want to be clear on this. When I say they're bad episodes, like I love Whom Gods Destroy. I just recognize it's not good television. Like Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, which I think is terrible television, also has sort of an enjoyable aspect to it. Okay, well that's sort of running through the list of episodes that I really truly like about it.
Because I think there's a solid 5 great episodes in season 3.
I'd probably go even higher than that, actually, which is kind of strange, given how cynical I've been of the episodes we're talking about. So I think we'll agree on the Enterprise incident, just off the bat. That's one of the best episodes the show
should have been the season premiere.
It's when you look at what was actually the season premiere, I think anything...
Well, it's insane, because you know we were talking about production order and air date order, right?
Yeah.
So the first episode aired infamously as Spock's Brain, okay? Yeah. But the first episode produced is Spectre of the Gun, right? Yeah. So even that would have been a better premiere than Spock's Brain. Like, what were you thinking?
Well, I mean, Spectre of the Gun is actually would be one of the ones that I really, really like about it. I really, really like the third season. I like that sort of broad, sort of like, I love the town as sort of like this half-constructed, because we haven't got the budget, but also because it's eerie, sort of Western frontier. I like the literalizing the space Western aspect of it. I also like Is There in Truth No Beauty, because it's a fantastic concept. I also like, say, Day of the Dove, Tholian Web. The Empath, I think, is massively underrated.
The Empath is, I believe that's DeForest Kelly's favorite episode. Or he was quoted at some point saying it was. So
cool, so I'm in good company there.
Good company.
And then, hold on, there's also, I actually like That Which Survives, which is like one of those outliers, which I can't explain and everybody's sort of forgotten about.
Was the last episode of the original series I ever saw.
Oh.
Like I'd seen them all up to that point. As I've mentioned a few times here, I have a Laserdisc collection, and I got the original series on Laserdisc because it was so cool. You know, you were talking about those 3 or 4 tapes, episodes per tape back in the day. Well, when I was a kid, you know, I used to see these Laserdiscs, you know, and they had 2 episodes per Laserdisc, and they were so cool. Anyway, I got a good price on them on eBay a few years ago, and I have the whole series on Laserdisc, and you know, I was going through the series, and I'm like, oh, I haven't seen this one. It's got Catwoman from Batman the movie in it. What's this all about? So it was interesting to like, you know, if you haven't seen it, it's new to you.
Yeah, and it has this sort of weird aspect. Like I also like Wink of an Eye as well, actually, because it has this sort of weird, like it's like they stopped doing science fiction at certain points of the third season. They're just like, let's do fairy stuff, let's do magic stuff. Like because it's basically a siren story on many levels, and like Wink of an Eye is basically like a fair folk story as well. And I like that one as well. And then All Our Yesterdays would be the last one that I would add to that list.
I agree. All Yesterdays is a really good episode. Had they finished the season 1 episode earlier?
You talk about just switching the episodes, the orders around on these things. Yeah, if they started 1 episode later or ended 1 episode earlier, maybe things would have been different.
I'm also partial to Savage Curtain as well. I found that a fun episode with Abraham Lincoln and Sir. Okay, talk about Star Trek mythology, right?
Yeah.
That introduces Serac.
Yeah.
It introduces Kalis. You know, yeah. I mean, these are major mythological figures, and I love how you describe Garth. Like, this guy is way more important than he should be. So are these guys, right?
Yeah, they are. And I mean, even like Kalis the Unforgettable, who's presented as this horrible sort of like, well, Klingons are pure evil, which is kind of interesting because like Day of the Dove is one of the first times that you get, I think in Errand of Mercy, you get a sense that Klingons are not necessarily pure evil. But I think in Day of the Dove is the first time that the Star Trek shows really look at, say, Klingons being, having their own code. And, like, you have this idea of honorable Klingons, which becomes a bigger deal in, say, Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, or when Ronald D. Moore takes over writing them in The Next Generation. But you have the seeds of that there in terms of what people think.
Kang is definitely the most honorable of the three main Klingons from TOS, being Kor, Koloth, and Kang. Kor is probably the most interesting of the three, and he ended up having the most screen time because he comes back the most in Deep Space Nine. But Kang is a solid number two.
Yeah, and Kang sort of has this, Kang has this sort of quality about him where, of the characters who are reinvented for Deep Space Nine, like, Kang is the character who would most fit in with, like, Next Generation Deep Space Nine.
Very true, very true, because, I mean, Koloth, that guy's completely reinvented. Like, I love that exchange, though, in Blood Oath when Odo's, like, looking at his pad, he looks up and Koloth is in there, he's like, how did you get in here? He's like, I am Koloth. It's like, that doesn't answer my question. Yes, it does. It's like, ooh, what a badass, right? Yeah, that is Cal, not the Koloth from TOS.
That's fantastic. He really is. And he was also great as Trelane as well. And, like, I actually, like, I really do like, I like the Trouble with Tribbles sort of version of Klingons, where they're basically, like, Romulans. They're what would become Romulans in later shows, where they're untrustworthy and coy.
That is, you know, that's something worth talking about here as we kind of peel back the onion, right? There is, and I have to agree, you know, there's a common this conversation point in Star Trek fandom that, you know, everything Ronald D. Moore did with the Klingons was great. You know, I love the Klingon saga, as they call it. But clearly, you know, for such a fan of TOS, like, someone along the way switched the Romulans and the Klingons, did they not? From, like, this honorable race to, like, the sneaky, the bad guy, you know? Like, and I get, like, oh, it's like the Cold War and we're friends with the Russians and da-da-da-da-da. That's what they were going for with the Klingons, but in doing that, they switched, like, the core
characteristics.
Of those races, right?
I mean, isn't the argument is, I think, that happened around Star Trek III, where during production, they originally wanted to use the Romulans. And that's why the Bird of Prey can cloak, for example, which is the first Klingon ship that can cloak. And it's called a Bird of Prey, I believe, as well. Mm-hmm. Which is
I love Star Trek III. Oh, we talk about Star Trek III a lot. That is my favorite of the Star Trek movies.
I love Star Trek III. I think it's horribly maligned and underrated. I think it's I think it's the first time you get an ensemble. The first time the original series sort of feels like more than just those three guys and the people they work with.
see, now we're getting some common ground here, guys. See, we might disagree on the season three. We're agreeing on the movies. No, I absolutely agree. But you look at the Enterprises in it, right?
Yeah.
They're using Romulans, no, using Klingon design, right? I love talking about that. Because they couldn't find the Bird of Prey model, right? So we have that mythology where there's Klingon-Romulan alliance, and then that carries on to Star Trek III, as you said, because they wanted to change from Romulans to Klingons because people thought, the understanding was, okay, the general public might be confused because Klingons and Vulcans look the same, Spock's people are bad guys, so at least use the Klingons, you know? And then that goes on to TNG, you get to, like, obviously Ronald D. Moore brings on this back, you have Duras working with the Romulans, you have Redemption, you know, there's always these Romulan-Klingon alliances throughout Star Trek, and that all starts back here in Season 3 of TOS because of a production thing.
And I go even further, and I'd say it's not just the Klingons and the Romulans that sort of begin with that. Like, DC Fontana, who wrote the episode, and was obviously, she was overwritten, she's not happy with how that played out, but Fontana is, like, one of the key world builders in terms of Star Trek, and so I would argue, like, Journey to Babel, which sort of laid the foundation of the Federation as this sort of multicultural entity, and, like, in terms of, like, the relations between Andorians, Tellarites, Vulcans, which sort of laid the path going forward. But the thing about the Enterprise incident is it's the first time that I think, and I'm willing to be corrected if I'm wrong here, but when I was watching it, it was the first time that it really seemed like the space in Star Trek belong to somebody other than the Federation and the people they were dealing with that week, in terms of, like, so you have the Cold War with the Klingons where they're interfering with, like, various planets in, like, Friday's Child or the Trouble with Tribbles. But this was the first time that the show seemed to say, well, look, okay, not only do the Federation exist and, say, the Romulans exist and the Klingons exist, but it's also, like, the Klingons and the Romulans exist when the Federation isn't looking at them. It's like it's not just like they stand still and pretend to do nothing for like the five episodes a year where neither of them appear. It's like, oh, by the way, they have their own agency and they have their own engagement, and that sort of gives you stuff like in The Next Generation, as you mentioned with the Romulans and Klingons, but even on, say, Deep Space Nine, which sort of embraced that a bit further, where you had like the relationships between the Cardassians had a different relationship with the Bajorans as compared to the Klingons, or you had like, one of my favorite things about Deep Space Nine is, like, say, the third season two-parter where the die is cast in Improbable Cause, where, like, this huge thing happens in terms of, like, galactic importance, in terms of, like, shaping the future of the shared Star Trek universe, which is where the Romulans and the Cardassians team up to attack the Dominion. And basically, this is a story that in no way involves the Federation. The Federation are just witnesses to this. They have no agency. They've not committed to doing this in any way, shape, or form. They've not allied with any of the parties. There's no sort of involvement in this. But it's like, these two governments got together, interacted with this third government, and it had this sort of ripple effect that sort of like created sort of cosmic waves that would affect everybody else, like the Klingons and the Federation stuff. And I feel like you can trace that back to like that innocuous line of dialogue in the Enterprise incident, where it's like, oh, by the way, the Klingons and the Romulans, they kind of know each other and they're kind of doing their own stuff when we're not interacting with them.
That's an excellent point. That kind of cements them as the two superpowers of TOS. I mean, the Klingons obviously appeared the most. Yeah. The Romulans only appeared three times. But when you put them together like that, you're like, oh man, these guys are, because you know, you didn't have the Gorn and the Tholians teaming up or something, right?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, yeah, the Doomsday Machine and the giant space amoeba have started emailing each other. We think they got a solid future there. But
very
it does
good, very good.
It sort of builds this idea of like a world that exists outside of the details of a particular episode, which I think is kind of important. And I think that like that becomes like a cornerstone of Star Trek that was, I think, solidified in terms of, like, say, the role-playing game. Like, nobody really talks about what happened after Star Trek went off the air that wasn't on screen, but you have stuff like, say, the role-playing game or the novels, which sort of build on these ideas and sort of, like, solidify this sense of, like, the Star Trek universe as something that is not just, like, the place where Kirk has adventures week after week, but it's like J.R.R. Tolkien's sort of Middle Earth, where you have this sort of like, you have this history and this context and this alliance and this sort of like these entities and these sort of engage. And I mean, one of the things I think that also shines through in the third season that wasn't there in the first two, and I mean, it was kind of there in the first two, but it wasn't solidified as much, is the sense of like the 23rd century as a utopian society. Like Gene Roddenberry's idea of like Star Trek as a future that is better and more optimistic and more hopeful explicitly. Like, I mean, it was there implicitly when you had like, you had Nichelle Nichols on the bridge and you had sort of George Takei on the bridge and you had Chekhov, who was a Russian serving with them as well, and this idea that everybody had put their differences behind them. But I think that in the third season, you start having these discussions about like infinite diversity and infinite combinations in like, is there in truth no beauty, for example. Mm-hmm. Or stuff like the discussion of Memory Alpha as this huge project. Yes, that Federation...
That's exactly what I was thinking of when you said that, like the total accumulation of all knowledge in the recorded galaxy. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's but people just come there and you see Lysa Zaytar is a terrible episode.
Yeah.
To quote you, it's one of the worst pieces of television. But you go down there and you see, oh, there was an Andorian, there's a Tellarite. You know, this was a place of all the races coming together. A proto Space Station Yorktown, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it has that sort of atmosphere as well. Like, and it's not even just in that one, because if it was just that one, you'd sort of write it off. But it plays through other episodes as well, like The Savage Curtain, where, for example, it's very clear, like, Kirk and Spock are the embodiment of good. It's like, they're not complicated characters. They're not sort of three-dimensional. So, like, Kirk no longer has a dark side like he did in The Enemy Within. No. Kirk and Spock are the representation of idealized sort of good in the universe, to the point where you can have them punch Space Hitler and Space Witch in the face, and obviously Kang. But yeah, it's there's this weird sense that sort of creeps through the third season of the show, where you get the sense that Roddenberry is beginning to understand maybe like what he believes. And it's worth noting, like, the Savage Curtain is written by Roddenberry as well, like towards the end of the season, and he insisted on the addition of like the IDEC to the third season as well. Arguably to help sell stuff for like Lincoln Industries for his own sort of.
There's no arguably about it.
I'm trying to be polite here.
Shatner and Nimoy like had a long conversation. Like they had like to pause filming that day to be like, hey, I'm not really comfortable doing this. I mean, that's Leonard Nimoy's whole falling out with Gene Roddenberry over for so many years was because just the ironically, the commercialization of Spock's image and Leonard Nimoy's image, you know, and this utopian society where there is no money.
Which is beautifully ironic. Like, infinite diversity and infinite combinations is the most wonderful sort of Star Trek utopian, idealistic, like, people are going to be better in the future sentiment. And it's also, by the way, buy this ornament. You can order it in our catalog. Please send money.
Most, it is the most, like, corporate shill move Star Trek has ever done. It's hilarious
and it's also,
to me.
The
juxtaposition of, and of rationalizing both of them is just hilarious to me.
Yeah, it is. And it's I think, like, that's the third season in a nutshell, where you have this sort of, like, you have all this great iconic sort of stuff that people think about when they remember Star Trek. And it's also, a lot of it is terrible. But it's also so essentially Star Trek. And it's that sort of thing where I feel like when I was mean, I'm sorry that I was mean about, you know, Let That Be Your Last Battle, because that is another example that where it's like, as a piece of television, I'm not a huge fan of it, but it is iconic Star Trek and it is quintessential Star Trek, and I think there's a lot of that across the third season as a whole, you know.
Well, yeah, and to get it back to kind of where we started jumping off, the public perception of Kirk as a ladies' man, you know, that is something that the J.J. Abrams films have completely
attached
themselves to. It's like, oh yeah, it's like, and I know it's not the case because you know Robert Orci is like a big Star Trek fan, you know. Yeah. And, I mean, Kurtzman and Abrams not so much. You know, Abrams is so, he's like, well, I like Star Wars better. Well, yeah, we can tell. Yeah, clearly. So good for you, JJ. Everything worked out for you in the end. But it worked out for Star Trek, too, because I think of the three, Beyond, it's probably the most true to Star Trek. And Justin Lin was a Star Trek fan growing up, and it shows. And that's its own conversation. But all that to say, they really, like, doubled down on the whole, yeah, Kirk's a ladies' man. I'm like, was that really necessary? It's almost, and like I said, I know this isn't the case, but it's like some people that had, they only had the pop culture understanding of Star Trek were given the, like, the script to write.
That's
the first
like,
two
I mean,
movies, right?
I've talked about this before, like, the Abrams movies. I like the Abrams movies a great deal. I think Star Trek has never worked as well on film as it has on television, so I don't mind the Abrams movies being sort of cartoon versions of Star Trek, where it is...
Yeah, you talk about season three being a cartoon. This is, like, the next level.
Yeah, it is, but it's like the popular memory of Star Trek, and it's like collectively people have remembered it without actually watching it, without actually going back. It's like if you ask somebody who had only heard Star Trek described, like, by people who had maybe watched it in reruns, like, you would end up with something like the Abrams movies, and I mean,
exactly,
that sounds horrible. That sounds like I'm being really mean. I'm not being really mean.
No,
I like,
so true though. And I love them too, but it's so spot on.
And I like that it's a version of Star Trek that I could show my girlfriend, for example, or I could, you know, my entire family who are not Star Trek fans could watch, because it's like it has that sort of familiar sheen of like feeling like people who have never watched Star Trek remember Star Trek being, to the point where like it has Kirk in bed with a green alien space babe, despite the fact that only happened once in the entire original series in an episode in the third season, which like it's, but that's become like what we associate with Kirk and with, you know, and the same with Spock as well, where Spock is this simmering sort of rage of like, it's not that like Spock is repressed, but he's so far repressed that he seems like he's constantly away from snapping the neck of every member of the senior staff. Like, you have this sort of, like, exaggeration of characteristics that were sort of nuanced and kind of, like, you know, sort of sketched and sort of developed very carefully in terms of the show and in terms of the films before. But because people remember, like, the exaggerated bit, the cartoonish bits. And I mean, even the production design of the third season, where the budget went down on the third season. So, like, when a lot of people think of Star Trek sets, they think about, like, the modernist design of, say, the Empath, which I absolutely love, where it's just a black space with, like, these, like, brightly coloured panels or things hanging from the ceiling. Or even, say, the Cloud City in Stratos, where it looks like everything is made of cardboard, and maybe there's a bit of modern art in a corner somewhere or something like that.
Exactly. It's the pop culture collective memory willed into being by the J.J. movies.
Manifested. But,
of Kirk, you know, I think there is a string of episodes here in season three that really cements the fact that, you know, Girl in the Report, Lady of the Week, you know, and he has a couple of failed attempts, you know, like Isn't There Truth, No Beauty? You can't tell, like, it's Kirk or Spock. I mean, which one, who's taking the lead on this one? You know, but overall, you know, you got the Paradise Syndrome, you have Whom Gods Destroy with like the scene where Marta tries to kill him, but then you got Mark Gideon. You got Requiem for Methuselah, and you got Wink of an Eye. Like those three right there are the big three.
It's also worth noting, like, Mark DeGideon, I can't believe I didn't talk about this. When we talk about Kirk as a lady killer, Mark DeGideon is an episode where an entire society has built its future on Kirk's virility. Like, Kirk is so manly that, like, his sort of machismo or sexual energy is going to single-handedly fix a society. Like, this is the third season. Like, Kirk is so much a ladies' man that you just beam him down to a planet and their problems are solved.
And you know, I'm not going to lie. Not only do I get those episodes confused, I get his love interest confused in Wink of an Eye and Mark Gideon. Because it's like, okay, it's the blonde girl with the ponytail. You know, and I think, yeah, and he gets pretty, I'm not sure, honestly, I don't remember which one, I think it's Wink of an Eye, but that's the one where, like, you cut back and he's, like, putting his boot back on. It's like, oh, I know what happened there, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of, that was a fairly quite risque for the time in terms of, like, primetime television. I will say, though, there is a very easy way to distinguish Wink of an Eye from Mark of Gideon. Wink of an Eye is good.
Okay, get noted. I haven't revisited that one in a while. I'll have to give it another watch sometime. Not to be confused with Blink of an Eye from Voyager.
Yes.
Which I believe Brandon Braga wanted to title Wink of an Eye until someone told him, oh, there's already a Star Trek episode named that. And much like they wanted to name Tuskansky. I can't even pronounce it, but they want the one with the rock. They wanted to name that arena. But again, they're like, hey, Brandon, there's already a Star Trek episode named that. Where is Manny Coda when you need him?
In Braga's defense, Roddenberry specifically told him not to go back and watch the original series. In his defense.
Well, you know, yeah, fair enough. He's doing good things nowadays on the Orville. So,
you do feel like it wouldn't be too hard for Braga just to have a search field, like a spreadsheet of names that have already been used, and just do a Control F. No, we use that one. But yeah, so that's pretty cool. Like, I mean,
and just tying it all in with like the romance, I think that's a key thing where, you know, I don't know when it's a trope in any TV show, especially an episodic TV show where it's like, oh, the romance of the week, you know, but on a show like The X-Files, you can't do it as much because you can't have the same two characters, Mulder and Scully, like finding someone every week. Like maybe like, what was it, like twice a season, right? When you have a show like that. But with Star Trek, like they were so desperate to make that happen. You know, we had our list of Kirks and then, you know, Spock's. Like I said, we had In There's No Truth, No Beauty. We had Enterprise Incident, the big one. Yeah. You had All Our Yesterdays, which is a very underrated episode. I think that's almost, I wouldn't quite call it Spock sitting on the edge of forever, but it serves close. The same purpose. Yeah. And then you have the Cloud Miners, where he's like putting his Mac on, putting the moves on. He's like, ooh, this is so incongruous to Spock's character. Like, but then you have to go past that, right? So they're like, okay, who else we got? McCoy. Yes. Let's give him a love interest, right? And that's great to see, because other than like the Man Trap, he hasn't really had anything going on that front.
This is what I'd argue with the third season as well. Like I mentioned earlier that I think the third Star Trek movie is the point at which Star Trek sort of becomes an ensemble, because I think when Spock dies or, you know, when Leonard Nimoy is written out, you have to then use all the other characters to tell a story. So you get all these wonderful little moments in Star Trek 3 where you have like Don't Call Me Tiny or, you know, Mr. Adventure with Uhura and stuff like that. And you have this idea that like the characters all have functions and all have lives outside of like being the woman who opens hailing frequencies or being the guy who sets course. In the third season, actually, and it's very clumsy, and you're right, it's very cynical, and it is sort of tied to this, well, who's going to fall in love this week? Let's spin the wheel. But you get this, the third season kind of has more focus, I think, on the broader characters than the first two, like in terms of like Scotty's romance in The Lights of Zatarnia, right? When you say it's not a good episode of television at all. But his romance in there is the most character development that he receives in the entire season, in the entire show, with the possible exception of, what is it, Wolf in the Fold, where it's like, maybe Scotty's a misogynist.
Or who moans for Adonis, you know?
Oh, yeah, maybe Scotty's a misogynist. or even stuff like, say, for example, the emphasis on Chekhov, Inspector of a Gun, for example. That sort of stuff. Or even, like, the attempt to give McCoy a love interest in, as you mentioned there, the wonderful title, Terrible Episode, For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. Like, it sort of gives a sense that maybe these characters have a bit more breadth to them than they would have had in earlier seasons. So I think even in, like, The Man Trap, for example, it's an ex-girlfriend as opposed to somebody who falls in love with
her. It is interesting. We talk about the beginning and end of Star Trek here, and I feel like in those early... If you do watch the early episodes, you see it is more of an ensemble show at the very beginning, because they're trying to figure out, okay, which character is going to fit. Like, The Man Trap, right? You have lots of Janice Rand and Sulu and Uhura gets her own scene. Like, you would never see that in, like, in season two, in, like, the heyday of Gene Kuhn, where it's like, no, it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. That's it.
That's what Scotty we're doing.
Can sometimes take command of the ship. That's it. And Chekhov can have a couple Russian jokes, and that's it. You know. Yeah. But then, as everyone kind of like settled into their roles, it's like, okay, well, Shatner's okay. He's the A plus star here. Oh, people love Spock more. Spock. Okay. Oh, people love McCoy. Let's elevate him to main character status. Yeah. And then that kind of cemented that, you know, the trifecta. And then everybody else really fell to the wayside quickly after, you know, during season one. But then you do start to see these other characters because you just run out of stories to tell. That's why. Yeah. That's why Scotty and McCoy get love interests. They were going to give Worf and the Fold to Sulu, but then discussions were like, well,
or something. Was that around the time?
That's a running joke around here to the Green Berets, but that's where Ken is today, by the way, filming the Green Berets. But no, actually, that they decided that James Doohan was a stronger actor than George Takei. That's why they gave him the love interest. And then also, This Side of Paradise was supposed to be a Sulu love story, but they're like, well, DC Fontaine's like, well, let's make it about Spock. That's more interesting. So Sulu always slighted. You know, he doesn't get the love interest, doesn't get to be Captain the Excelsior until Star Trek VI, even though it was planned all the way back in Star Trek II. So,
and then, he does, you know, get a shirtless scene.
That's true. But we, you know, we've been discussing here because we recently did me and Brandon Shea Mattella did a commentary on Cat's Paw. Like I said, we like to talk about the worst episodes. And we realized, like, every time Sulu goes down on a away mission, it goes terribly wrong. Like Return of the Archons, he gets brainwashed. Cat's
Squire
Paw,
Gothos
he gets,
as well.
He gets brainwashed. One, yeah. He gets frozen in Squire to Gothos. It's just like, come on, man. The cat can't catch a break. But all that to say, you know, if I think, and it, or if you, by the way, are you familiar with Star Trek Continues, the fan show?
I haven't watched it. I've heard of it.
It is amazing, by the way, and they're actually just wrapping up. They had 11 episodes total, right. And then
this is with the new
CBS
rules and stuff to
yes,
mention.
Yes, because
that,
CBS changed their fan rules due to
that,
due to
that
some
TV
reasons.
Show that we mentioned involving a certain Garth.
There are lots of reasons, but all that to say, Star Trek Continues is amazing. It is like, if you think of a fan production, like this is not that. This is like so well done. The attention to detail is amazing. The acting is great. I highly recommend it. As someone who's very critical of fan films, you know, being in the production world myself, I sniff out bad production value like nobody's business. And I love it. And seeing how big a Star Trek fan you are, Darren, you're going to love it too. But all that to say, they do introduce some new characters, and people are like, oh, they would never do that. Bah. I'm like, actually, they probably would, because as you can already see in season three, they're starting to expand their scope of like who's on the Enterprise, yeah. Who's doing what today. You would have to do that as to make it sustainable if you're going to go to the full 5-year mission. So that just reminded me of that, because they have brought on some other characters, and some people have been kind of hot and cold. I'm like, that's not the Star Trek that I know from the 79 episodes. Bah. It's like, hey, you got to evolve and change and grow. But all I can say,
series.
Check it out. You'd like it. Yeah, well, it's Mr. Erickson and Imres.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not as if there isn't precedent for this. Like, what about the second season, where it's like, who the hell is this, like, Russian fan of the monkeys, and what is he doing on my bridge?
If only there was an internet back in 67.
Oh, dear
amazing.
God, can you imagine? I don't want to imagine.
Oh man, but yeah, you know, so season three, you know, it's interesting to talk about, and you know, that's what we look for here on Standard, because look, let's face it, guys, Star Trek's 50 years old. There's only 79 episodes of the original series. There's only so many times you can talk about The Trouble with Tribbles or, you know, The City on Legend Forever, even though we did mention it in this episode. It's interesting to kind of find new angles. That's what Kenny and I are always trying to do here, find new angles on old material. And thank goodness we have the Kelvin timeline movies to talk about. That's a whole other world of possibilities to give us in our wheelhouse here at Standard Orbit on our modus operandi of discussion. But yeah, talking about stuff like season three or these random other episodes that nobody really talks about, it's fun because it's untapped ground. And I don't feel like I'm just regurgitating something that someone said 30 times when I start talking about, you know, Requiem for Methuselah, right? It's like, no, who talks about that episode?
Yeah.
You know? Any final thoughts then?
Not at all. I was actually, being honest, when I rewatched it recently, I've rewatched Star Trek a couple of times, obviously because I'm a big fan. When I rewatched the third season, I was just amazed at how much of what I recognized of Star Trek was there, despite the fact that there's a lot that is not Star Trek there, and it's, you know, there's a lot that's weird and uncomfortable and not very good. But there's a lot there that is interesting and intriguing, but there's also a lot there, as we talked about, that feels like it informed a lot going forward that doesn't maybe get recognized as such. You know, I think that the third season is kind of the red-haired stepchild of the 3 years, and understandably so, because it's not as good as the first two, but I think it is a very important part of the show's legacy and history, and I think it's sort of fascinating to go back and to sort of look at it in that way.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said. Well, Darren, it's been fun talking Star Trek with you today. If people want to find you elsewhere on the internet or otherwise, where can they find you?
let's just keep it on the internet. I feel very uncomfortable otherwise. But no,
you don't want to give out your personal address? That's what I was going for there. But
that was kind of coy, Zach. I like it. You play it cool. You're like Spock more than Kirk. You're like Spock of the Cloud Miners. I've never podcasted with a work of art before.
Very good.
But you can find me online at Twitter at Darren_Mooney. You can find me at The Movie Blog with a zero instead of an O in the word movie. I also podcast on The 250, which is a weekly podcast that looks at the top 250 movies of all time as voted for IMDb. I occasionally podcast on The Xcast. In fact, myself and Zach, I think this week, will be doing an episode. So you can catch in and sort of catch this sort of repartee again. I've also very luckily, I've had the opportunity to write a book on The X-Files, opening The X-Files, which is available from all good booksellers now. So if you are interested in The X-Files, or if you know somebody coming up to Christmas who is interested in The X-Files, or even just have a public library that could do with a section on The X-Files, please feel free to share the word and sort of get that out there.
Your book.
Yeah, just over and over again. Because you don't want to be in a situation where somebody arrives in and they're like, I really want that book on The X-Files written by this Irish guy, Darren Mooney, but all the other books are checked out. You don't want to take that risk. So I'd say buy in bulk. You can probably get a discount. That's what I'm going for here. But no, I am. I mostly discuss popular culture. So, for example, I recently finished reviewing Deep Space Nine, all of Deep Space Nine, all 7 years of it. And sort of when I was doing it, I thought I'd go back, I'd dig into, provide a bit of cultural context in terms of like where, what was happening in popular culture when the show was on, and in terms of also just stuff like behind the scenes stuff, which I mean, most people listening to this podcast probably already know, so there's very little interesting there. But they're just kind of, I like delving into stuff like that. And if you are interested in sort of long form reads or sort of like research sort of stuff, or even just like pop culture discussion, maybe give it a look. Hopefully it'll be of interest. I hope anyway.
Well, listeners, as you can tell, Darren is a well-read, well-spoken guy. He has got a lot of knowledge about a lot of things, and it's always a pleasure delving into to nerd discussion with you, Darren.
Thank you very much, Zach. It's always a pleasure to talk with you as well. Like.
Well, it's been fun talking about a third season of TOS today, but that's not the only thing going on Trek FM this week. Here's a quick look at what else you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Meta Treks.
See, Mike, I think Stamets actually got it wrong. Actually, it's the Metachlorians that allow Catrick communication to take place.
No. That's the wrong franchise.
Oh, wrong franchise. Sorry. I see what you're describing as an attempt to kind of naturalize this mystical interpretation of Vulcan Catrus.
The 602 Club.
Right, because, I mean, they're starting off with this auction, and it seems like they're on a mission to figure out who is stealing. And then go in this completely different direction of being concerned about warheads.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, when I was thinking about this, I mean, there are a lot of scary scenes or episodes, but for me, it absolutely has to be Phantasms, where Data is dreaming and he sees Troy as a cake and has to take like the slice of her.
Oh my, that's scary.
I mean, that well, okay, but.
This is
also
your number one.
Also within that
one?
Scene. Hold on.
Okay.
To the journey!
I always want to know, why haven't they done that Gardener Forever movie in general? For me, that's like such a cool go-to concept. Yeah. Like, if you're going to make a Star Trek movie, get the Gardener Forever in there. That would be awesome. And no one has ever thought that was cool enough to do yet. So we're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it never really gets reprised that much, does it? Except, obviously, in the animated series. We do get the Iconian Gateways later, which are a similar sort of concept, aren't they? But
not the same.
Well, they don't talk back to you.
I don't think you can travel through time with those, can you? I think they're more just space.
The final frontier. These are the... Oh, sorry.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcast. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course in the Babel Conference. Type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek FM and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit: Norman Lau, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So, Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Hey, you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO, and we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.